This is WNYC, AM, FM, and HD, New York.
Hi, I'm Leonard Lopate. On today's show, Dr. Jeffrey Taubman talks about helping the isolated and impoverished people in the Himalayas and in other parts of the Third World fight cataract blindness. And then Lauren Sandler, an only child and the parent of an only child, argues that there are major benefits from growing up in a single-child household. And we invite you to tell us whether you agree by offering your thoughts on our show page. Also, Claire Massoud on her latest novel, The Woman Upstairs, about an angry elementary school teacher who's life has changed when she befriends a new family in her neighborhood. And our gurus of how-to, Alvin and Lawrence Hugh Bell, will be taking your calls on home repair. That's what's coming up after the news. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. Stick around.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The source of last week's explosive revelations about the government surveillance programs is speaking out again in his own defense. Edward Snowden, who has taken refuge in Hong Kong, tells the South China Morning Post he has no intention to hide from justice but to reveal criminality. Asked why he chose Hong Kong to fight the U.S. government, Snowden says he has no reason to doubt the jurisdiction system. It answers to China but maintains a Western-style legal system. The Obama administration is still considering whether to bring charges against Snowden. Colorado fire authorities are preparing to send up C-130 cargo planes to help firefighters on the ground northeast of Colorado Springs. The Black Forest Fire is among four along Colorado's Front Range that have destroyed dozens of homes and forced thousands of people to evacuate. El Paso County, Colorado Sheriff Terry Makita says many residents will not be able to return home today.
It's still a very hot and active fire area, and even this morning you could hear explosions around some of the front line of that fire from propane tanks and other fuel sources.
Evacuees include more than 900 inmates at a state prison south of Colorado Springs. All of the fire spread quickly yesterday, fanned by strong winds. The Cleveland man accused of holding three women hostage for a decade has pleaded not guilty to hundreds of kidnapping, rape, and murder charges. Ariel Castro was arraigned today in a Cleveland courtroom. For member station WKSU, Kevin Niedermeyer has the latest.
Wearing an orange jumpsuit, Ariel Castro never raised his head during the short court appearance. His attorney, Greg Weinthrop, says many of the 329 charges cannot be disputed, but he questions the need for the two murder charges for allegedly terminating pregnancies of one of the women.
It is our hope that we can continue to work toward a resolution to avoid having an unnecessary trial about aggravated murder and the death penalty.
Weinthrop says adding aggravated murder and death penalty questions to the trial will put added emotional stress on the victims. The three women escaped last month after neighbors heard one of them screaming for help. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Niedermeyer in Cleveland.
Attorneys are presenting opening statements in the racketeering trial of reputed mobster James Whitey Bulger, once one of the nation's most infamous fugitives until he was captured 2 years ago. Bulger is charged in connection with 19 killings in the 1970s and 80s. But today, a federal prosecutor told jurors the 83-year-old was at the heart of murder and mayhem in Boston for nearly 30 years. The defense plans to attack the credibility of the prosecution's key witnesses, three of Bulger's former associates. At last check on Wall Street, Dow Jones Industrial Average down 55 points at 15,066. From Washington, this is NPR News.
And from New York, this is WNYC at 12:04. Good afternoon, I'm Richard Hake. Police are involved in a standoff on the Lower East Side with a suspect in the 2010 killing of a Pace University student. The NYPD spokesman Paul Brown says officers went to arrest the man at the Smith Houses. Earlier this morning, he refused to come out of the apartment. Three other people are inside, including children. It's not clear whether the man is armed. The mayor says he will not pull homes and businesses away from the coastline in his climate change plans for the city. The $20 billion proposal to protect the city from future storms includes beach replenishment projects, as well as flood walls, bulkheads, and an elevated neighborhood along the East River. Here's Seth Pinsky, president of the Economic Development Corporation.
It's multi-layered defenses. You start with the coastline. You then think about buildings. And in some cases, that may mean elevation. In some cases, that may mean just protection of critical systems so that if flooding occurs, the elevator doesn't go out, electricity doesn't go out. And then you also have to think about all the systems that support those buildings and protect those too.
Pinsky was on the Brian Lehrer show earlier today. Mayor Bloomberg says city and federal Sandy relief would provide $10 billion for the project, and Washington could kick in another $5 billion. In Albany, a Democratic state senator says he's against financing campaigns with tax dollars, delivering a blow to efforts to force a vote on the proposal. Senator Ruben Diaz tells the Associated Press he doesn't support the public financing of campaigns, and he won't join the effort by fellow Democrats to bring a bill to the floor in the Senate. And New Jersey Transit's board has approved a proposal to provide wireless internet services on trains and on the train platforms, but it's not clear if it will cost commuters. The contract is with Cablevision for 20 years and won't cost NJ Transit anything. This is WNYC.
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, working to help states provide voters with timely, accurate election information at pewtrust.org.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Dr. Jeffrey Tabin has climbed the seven summits, was a bungee jumping pioneer, and now aims to eradicate blindness in third world countries. As impossible as that may sound, he and his partner, Dr. Sandra Gruitt, have pioneered an inexpensive, cost-effective method for treating preventable blindness. And through the Himalayan Cataract Project, an organization they founded in 1994, they have provided 400,000 eye treatments and 40,000 surgeries for people in remote parts of the developing world who might otherwise have been blind for life. The late David Oliver Rellen wrote about their efforts in a book called Second Sons. It's published by Random House, and I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Jeffrey Tabin to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me, Leonard.
Now, you took up mountain climbing long before you began working with Dr. Ruitt, before you got your medical degree. And climbed the seven summits?
Actually, I started out rock climbing, and I was pretty focused on short rock climbing. I used to climb a lot outside of New York here at the place called the Shawangunks outside of New Paltz, and migrated out to Yosemite, focused on big wall rock climbing, and eventually spread a bit into the mountains.
Well, not just the mountains. The seven summits are the tallest.
The highest. It's funny. It's sort of a nice little compilation that's good for giving a nice succinct slideshow. But I was really focused on really doing rock climbs and big mountain climbs I wanted to do. And one day I looked up and I had climbed six of the highest peaks on the seven continents. And the only one I hadn't done was one of the arguably easiest, which was Mount Elbrus in Europe.
So you'd done K-12?
Well, K-2 is the second highest. I have not climbed K-2, but I'd climbed. I was with the team that pioneered the first ascent of the east face of Mount Everest back all the way in 1983.
And then David Rellen writes that you also participated in the first modern bungee jumps in Bristol, England. You were a philosophy major at the time?
I went to college first in the States. I went to Yale. And then after college, I was given a scholarship to go to Oxford for 2 years. And that actually was really a transforming time in several ways. One, I was all set to go to medical school, and I had an interest in maybe sports medicine. But going to Oxford, I was able to step back and studying philosophy, look at the philosophy of healthcare delivery around the world, healthcare economics, and it really changed my focus to wanting to do something for the poorer countries in the world. It also expanded my climbing horizons. Oxford had these indigenous trust funds that were remnants of the days when Oxford students were supposed to civilize various aspects of the world. And they had one in particular called the A.C. Irvine Grant for Oxford students to enjoy a strenuous holiday in mountains abroad. And it turned out that the more exotic of a locale you chose, the more cash money they gave you. And so my partner and I were able to expand our climbing horizons, which eventually led to my climbing, but it also led to the bungee jumping.
You participated in the first modern bungee jump in 1979?
It's sort of a non-skill activity. There's a group that I used to hang out and party with called the Oxford Dangerous Sport Club. And they were focused on creating new, challenging, dangerous sport. And they had just returned from the first ever magma surfing expedition. They had stolen stationery from the Oxford Geology Department, identifying them as an official Oxford geologic expedition, and they were going to be doing seismographic studies of a volcano erupting in the South Pacific. They penetrated a large evacuation corridor and had homemade asbestos surfboards and asbestos suits and did the first ever magma surf. And at the
That's when people still trusted asbestos.
Yeah. No complaints about the lungs so far. But anyway, so they came back. I used to just kind of hang out with them. And one of the people in the club also climbed a bit. And I had gotten this A.C. Irvine grant to go to Irianjaya in New Guinea, where there's a glaciated mountain on the equator, to try and climb a big unclimbed vertical north face on that mountain. And we were at a party, and the head of the Oxford Dangerous Sport Club named David Kirk came to me and said, "So, Jeff, you're going to New Guinea. You must try vine jumping." And he was referring to a puberty ritual where they build towers and you tie vines to the ankles and dive off the towers. And actually, just for your readers or listeners' edification, it's actually done in Vanuatu, not in New Guinea, but it was a mistake. And over a evening of quite a few pints of beer, we came up with the idea of urbanizing New Guinea vine jumping, and we did the first ever bungee jump was off the Clifton Suspension Bridge in Bristol, England.
And you were arrested.
And then we were arrested, and that got a little publicity, and we ended up being picked up by a TV show called That's Incredible. And some of your listeners may remember the opening sequence to a TV show called That's Incredible was me in a white tuxedo jumping off the Royal Gorge Bridge in Canyon City, Colorado.
Okay, so you said you were interested in sports medicine. How'd you wind up in ophthalmology?
Well, really very fortuitous. There's been a lot of great serendipity, and I've had some amazing teachers and role models. And I began, as I mentioned, through both the study at Oxford and also being afforded the privilege to travel to some of the poorer countries in the world, really wanting to do something about the disparity in healthcare and something about healthcare in the poorer regions. And a lot of the issues, really, Leonard, are public health. You know, it's problems of clean water, just abject poverty, not having vaccinations, poor diet. And I was working as a general doctor in Nepal, and I saw the miracle of cataract surgery. And it was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen. People were totally blind. And where I was working, it was just accepted that you get old, your hair turns white, your eye turns white, and then you die.
But cataract surgery was commonplace in England and the United States, and in fact, in the developed world. Why was this such a surprise to you?
Well, it was a surprise to me at how many people were blind. And right now in our world, there are 18 million people are unable to do the tasks of daily living. They can't see a shadow of a hand move in front of their face because they're blind in both eyes because of a cataract.
Are cataracts more common in certain parts of the world than others?
They're a little more common, but also there's a lack of doctors. And this was back in 1989. And in America, we have one ophthalmologist for every 18,000 people. In Nepal, in 1989, there was no doctor performing modern cataract surgery with a lens implant. At that time, the population was 24 million. And there was an estimated backlog of about 200,000 blind people. And I watched a Dutch team, and it was really the most amazing thing. You know, another expression for a blind person in Nepal was a mouth with no hands. And when you're in a subsistence agrarian economy and you have a mouth with no hands, it's a huge burden. There are kids who can't go to school. They have to lead their parents around. People get depressed. They shrivel up. The life expectancy is about one-third that of age and health match peers. And I watched a Dutch team come in, and it was just a miracle. It was, almost biblical. It was biblical. People were straightening up. You know, one minute after the patches came off, they could see. We actually have a study we published in the American Journal of Ophthalmology that the results in these absolute, totally blind cataract patients, 80% see well enough to pass the American driver's test the day after surgery. And there's this just incredible experience just watching. I still get a thrill out of it where you have the patch come off, there's this look of disbelief, and then the recognition they can see, and then the smile.
Well, I had cataract surgery some years back, and although I wasn't blind, things seemed to have gotten darker, although I wasn't really aware of it because it was such a gradual process, until I had the intraocular lens put into my eye, and suddenly I realized the sky was a very vivid blue, not the muddy color that I was used to.
And if you can imagine that, from going from totally blind to seeing perfectly, and I went, wow, this is something that I really want to do with my life. And I'd already finished medical school, and I came back and was fortunate to get a great position to train as an ophthalmologist.
And how did you come to meet Dr. Ruitt?
Again, a bit of serendipity. I was looking, you know, one, I already had a love for Nepal, having been there climbing several times. And at the time I was finishing my residency, which was back in the early 90s, the one Western ophthalmologist who was really advocating not going over and doing cataract surgery for the poor people in the developing world, but really teaching and empowering and developing systems, was an Australian ophthalmologist named Fred Hollows. And I began corresponding with Fred during my residency. And what I didn't know was that Sandok Ruitt, who was already the best-trained ophthalmologist in Nepal, was living in Fred's home. And they were working together to figure out how to bring state-of-the-art, absolute best-quality eye care from the West to the developing world and deliver it at a very low cost. So I went and did my fellowship in Australia under the Fred Hollows Foundation. Unfortunately, Fred passed away from renal cancer, and I went and did my fellowship, and they sent me to work with Dr. Ruitt, which just blew me away.
He comes across as a bit of a character in David Relland's book, stern, even grumpy at times. And he wasn't impressed by your resume when you first met him. Do you think you've won him over by now?
Well, by now he's my brother, but we've been working together for almost 20 years. But it was very interesting. He's from an amazing background, and always, you know, gives me pause when I'm in some of these poorest countries and I see someone in the most destitute situation. How would I have thrived had I been born into that environment? He was born in arguably the poorest place in Nepal. Several days' walk from the nearest road, no schools, no electricity, no facilities, 40-minute walk to the nearest river to get water. And he ended up getting a scholarship to one of the best medical schools in India, training at the All India Institute of Medical Sciences in Delhi, retraining in first the Netherlands and then in Australia. And he's a very introverted man, and I came over to, I thought, you know, having all the highest pedigree training sites on my resume, and that I would be over to teach something, and I was just absolutely blown away. And he had developed this amazing system of doing very high volume surgery at very low cost, giving absolute quality to everyone. And he wasn't very impressed by me at all. And actually, reading the book, I actually found out that he tried to get rid of me. I worked with him just for 3 weeks during my fellowship, and I said, wow, this is the greatest thing ever. I want to come back and work with you. And in Nepal, they don't actually, it's a very non-confrontational society. They won't say no. They kind of defer a question. Well, they say, well, maybe. And even if you have a very well-educated person on the street and you know a temple's one block to the right, you say, is the temple this way pointing to the left? They'll always say yes rather than contradict you. So he said, really not no. And I came back after my fellowship to work with him. And I only learned from the book that he sent me to southern Nepal to a place called Bharatnagar during the monsoon. He said, you have to reorganize this eye hospital. And it was 100 degrees with 100% humidity, mosquitoes, snakes. And I thought he sent me there because this is a great challenge. We really need to bring eye care to this region. But he actually sent me there because he thought no Westerner would ever survive a week and he'd get rid of me.
My guest is Dr. Jeff Tabin, co-founder and chairman of the Himalayan Cataract Project, with the man who sent him off into that awful situation, Dr. Sanduk Ruith. They are the subjects of a new book called Second Suns, S-U-N-S, Two Doctors and Their Amazing Quest to Restore Sight and Save Lives. It's written by the late David Oliver Rellin and published by Random House. We will continue our conversation after this. We are back with Dr. Scott Tabin, co-founder and chairman of the Himalayan Cataract Project and a professor of ophthalmology and visual sciences and co-director of the Division of International Ophthalmology at the University of Utah's John A. Moran Eye Center. He is the subject, along with Dr. Sanduk Ruith, who is the co-founder of that cataract project, and the medical director of the Tilganga Institute of Ophthalmology in Kathmandu, Nepal, of a new book called Second Suns, written by the late David Oliver Rellin and published by Random House. Now, you said that you came up with an inexpensive way of doing cataract surgery. Cataract surgery can cost $3,000 or so in this country, but it costs less than $20 when the
material
costs.
Well, first I'd like to say, whenever I say we, I say it relatively grandly, because Dr. Ruith is really largely the genius behind our program, and I'm kind of the enthusiastic fat boy who plays because I bring the ball. But Dr. Ruith had already, at the time in the early 90s, there was no one in the entire developing world that put the lens implant in, the type that you had, Leonard, that allows that crisp focus and seeing the blue sky the way it should be seen. And one of the problems was the cost of the lens implants. The original way that cataract surgery was done, sort of the first modern, was created by a German doctor named von Graefe in the 1880s.
And you had to stay still for a long time.
Who would
after
basically
the
splice the eye in half, take the whole lens out. You'd have to stay on your back for a week. And then they'd give these thick Coke bottle-like glasses, which even when things were performed perfectly, give distortions when you look off the center. And Dr. Ruith was the first developing world doctor to say we really need the modern lens implant technology to focus light. But the least expensive intraocular lens implant on the world market was several hundred dollars and absolutely impossible. In addition, you needed microsurgical skills, you needed a microscope, and the established paradigm for the developing world was this was not appropriate. And Fred Hollows actually was at an international meeting, which I attended when I was a first-year resident, and he said we really need to develop it. And he had the foresight to start a factory to manufacture the intraocular lenses in Kathmandu at our center, and it brought the cost down from several hundred to $4 a lens, with having our materials, medications manufactured in Asia, and then having a high-volume system where no one does anything that someone with lesser skills can do.
But you and Dr. Ruith would work for more than 12 hours at a time doing these surgeries.
We continue to.
How many do you do in a day? And don't you lose focus after a while?
I don't, actually. For me, it's a meditative thing. It's sort of similar to rock climbing. I'm an absolute focus on each of the smallest motions. I've done over 100 in a day. We have a couple of our young surgeons in Nepal now who have done over 200 in a day.
Because part of the project is teaching other people to do these
things.
It's
all teaching and developing a system and teaching at all levels, teaching ophthalmic nurses, ophthalmic technicians, ophthalmic assistants. We have a one-year program after eighth grade to train assistants, a three-year program after high school to train technicians, a year program after nursing school, as well as training the doctors. And then we're also bringing some of our best young doctors to the University of Utah Moran Eye Center, where we're giving them subspecialty training. And we now have subspecialty fellowships as well as full ophthalmology residencies.
When we read about healthcare in the developing world, it's usually about AIDS, HIV/AIDS, and diseases like malaria, tuberculosis, dengue fever, less about cataracts and other kinds of blindness.
I know, and I think that's actually a terrible thing. It's one of the things we're in the midst of doing a large project in Ethiopia where we had 1,200 blind people, 600 with cataracts, 600 from non-treatable causes. And we did a very extensive surveys looking at both the direct and the indirect cost of the blindness. How many people can't work? But how many children can't go to school because they're taking care of a blind parent? And then we did a cataract intervention where we were able to treat over 550 of the cataract cohort. And as we speak, our numerators from the project from Addis Ababa University are interviewing those patients, and we're trying to get hard numbers on the cost benefit of the intervention, looking at how many people in each of the groups have died in the last year. Several studies have shown that the life expectancy once you go blind is one-third that of age and health-matched peers. And for children, it's much worse.
In Africa, it's often other factors like flies that...
Well, they cause trachoma, which is an infectious disease that causes people to go blind at a very early age. It's endemic in Ethiopia and that whole band. River blindness, which is also spread by the bite of black flies. And worldwide, 85% of the blindness is preventable or treatable.
Now, is it difficult to set up the kinds of facilities necessary for doing this sort of thing in some really remote areas?
Well, that's one of the exciting things is it's really, you know, a cataract intervention is lifelong. You have your cataract surgery with a lens implant, you see the rest of your life. Somebody with multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis, we can keep alive, but they need expensive drugs the rest of their life. The same thing with malaria, the same thing with HIV/AIDS. Whereas eye care, in terms of cost effectiveness, is really the most efficacious area we can address in medicine right now in the developing world.
Why is there such a high incidence of cataracts in the Himalayas? Is it because people are living at a high altitude?
Has been the lack of doctors. When Dr. Reed started, he was the only eye surgeon doing modern cataract surgery for 30 million people versus one in 18,000 here in America. The second is the intense UV light, which causes oxidative damage to the proteins in the lens of the eye. All a cataract is a slow breakdown in the crystalline structure of the lens proteins, which is a little focusing device right behind the pretty colored part of the eye called the iris.
So it leads to a discoloration.
So the first thing is the intense UV light, but a second, it causes oxidative damage, just having a lack of antioxidants in the diet. People who subsist just on potatoes or just on rice and don't have green leafy vegetables in their diet. A third factor is bad water. There are a lot of fluid shifts with chronic diarrhea, chronic dysentery that leads to a much faster breakdown of these lens proteins.
So I would assume that people in the Andes might also
Absolutely.
Have problems.
Absolutely. The Altiplano, Bolivia, Peru.
Are you doing work there
also
as well?
We're not. We're working, although we've had several doctors from South America come to train in Nepal with us and to learn our system. And we're trying to, it's really a system of eye care. It's not just the cataract surgery. But our active programs are throughout Asia and now throughout Africa.
The author of this book about you, David Oliver Rellen, went to Nepal to write about mountain climbing and then had a conversation with you that made him switch topics?
Well, I'd like to take credit for it, but He actually was seeing Dr. Rui and seeing the miracle of cataract care. He was on his way to go to Nepal. He was thinking of doing a book on Apa Sherpa, who's the record-setting Sherpa who's climbed Mount Everest 20 times. And Apa was with me on Everest in 1988 and is a very good friend. And I told him, if you're going to Nepal, you've got to see Dr. Rui. He's a national hero. He's the most amazing man I've ever met on this planet. And I was hoping that he would at least just write a magazine article about him. And he came, he met him, and within an hour, Dr. Rui swept him up to go to a remote eye camp, and he watched the miracle of cataract surgery and someone totally blind having their sight restored and the way it changed their life and switched his topic.
Well, isn't there something of a cloud hanging over him? Because he was the ghostwriter on Three Cups of Tea. And then he committed suicide after the brouhaha about that.
Well, you know, he was a wonderful man. And David was a great journalist who really took pride in his work. And he got he's very passionate about trying to use journalism, or was passionate about trying to use journalism to change the world. And he was very excited about building schools, educating girls in the Islamic world, in Pakistan, Afghanistan, was so excited about the story and just wanted to tell the story well. And it was a story told to him by Greg Mortensen. And when the furor came up over some of the misuse of funds from the Central Asia Institute and some of the inaccuracies about Three Cups of Tea, he felt really horrible. And he had discussed with Greg and the publisher, but he really was just the writer of the book. And he was very excited about our project in that he came with me to Asia a half dozen times, plus went on a couple other trips with Dr. Rui. He came with me to Africa twice, and he really was writing and wrote this book from his own personal perspective. In terms of his suicide, I personally just feel horrible. He was one of the really great people who I've had the privilege of spending time with, and it's not in the book, but he was so moved by a lot of the things that there are more than a dozen kids that he met who had their sight restored or were able to go to school because their parents' sight was restored, who he was quietly paying for them to go to school.
Could Dr. Rui's methods be applied to the United States?
There are an awful lot that could. And I would love to have the opportunity to sit with President Obama's medical advisors and talk about some of the things that could be easily transported. One thing that we're doing very well at is having a system where no one does anything that someone with lesser skills can do. And in America, we're really looking for that one worst case option where something could go wrong. And if it's 1% better and 100% more expensive, when it comes to medical care, we force to go with it. And there are a lot of things that we can do to streamline the process, eliminate the waste, and certainly bring down a lot of the costs.
I've been speaking with Dr. Jeffrey Taban, who is one of the subjects of David Oliver Rellen's book, Second Sons, Two Doctors, and Their Amazing Quest to Restore Sight and Save Lives. It is published by Random House. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Leonard, thank you so much. It's been a real honor and privilege for me.